Hi, it's Mountain Edition, all the week's news from the Roaring Fork Valley coming at you in the next half hour. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Wyatt Orme. Thousands of teachers rallied at the state capitol last week. They want more school funding.
Stream flows in the Roaring Fork watershed are creeping upward, but this year's low snowpack is already starting to show.
An exhibition on Ute Indian culture is making its way around the western slope.
And the Forest Service plans to log 1,600 acres in the upper Frying Pan Valley.
The biggest stories from this week coming up on Mountain Edition.
Stream flows in the Roaring Fork watershed are slowly creeping upward, but as Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, the effects of this winter's low snowpack are already showing.
Snowpack in the Roaring Fork watershed this year peaked at about 80% of normal, and that means experts project that stream flows will be well below average as well. River levels in the Roaring Fork Valley are rising this week as warmer temperatures and April sunshine speeds up snowmelt and runoff, but they are still well below average. Liza Mitchell of Roaring Fork Conservancy says they'll be keeping an eye on how low stream flows dip this year.
Because low flows can be bad for us ecologically speaking, also just in terms of our economies and recreation that's based on that.
The Roaring Fork is currently running as low as 68% of average in the lower valley. Peak runoff is expected to be earlier than normal this year, too. That usually happens in late May or early June. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
A traveling exhibition on Ute culture is making its way around the western slope, and a Ute drumming demonstration will be held in Aspen this weekend. They both provide an opportunity to learn about the tribe's past and present.
The exhibit Seasons of the Nooch, Transitions of the Ute People, includes photos and stories that are organized by season. That's meant to reflect the cyclical way that the Ute people view time. Lisa Hancock, Aspen Historical Society's curator of collections, says the exhibit is focused on much more than historical artifacts.
The Ute people are not a past tense culture. They are a current culture. So we juxtapose historic images with modern day color images.
This month, Seasons of the Nooch is on display at the Rifle Branch Library. After that, it heads to the Grand Valley Historical Society. On Saturday, members of the Northern Ute Tribe will perform a drumming demonstration at the Aspen Art Museum starting at 3.
On Monday, the U.S. Forest Service announced its final decision to log 1,600 acres of national forest in the Upper Frying Pan Valley. As Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports, some areas have been removed from the project after public objections.
The project is meant to supply wood to local mills and biomass plants. It has seen strong opposition from neighbors, environmental groups, and local government. The Forest Service received 12 formal letters of opposition, and District Ranger Karen Troyer says they worked collaboratively with those groups to address many of their concerns in this final decision.
We think because of that dialogue that we've had that we do have a better final decision.
Troyer removed 128 acres from the logging project. She says that was in response to an objection filed by Wilderness Workshop. In response to concerns from the town of Basalt over heavy traffic on Frying Pan Road, contractors will only be able to haul timber through Basalt for 2 years. 7 objections still stand, including from homeowners who say it's not appropriate to log in this valley at all. The Forest Service will put the contract out for bid this year, with work likely starting in the summer of 2019. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
On Sunday, Chinese dissident and artist Ai Weiwei's documentary Human Flow was screened in Basalt. Kristen has more.
Ai Weiwei was born in China to 2 writers. His filmmaking and art explores themes of oppression, rebellion, and freedom. His own displacement during his childhood led to his interest in the struggles of current refugees. Human Flow looks at the migration in 23 different countries caused by conflicts in Africa, violence in Central America, and the war in Syria. Later this summer, Ai Weiwei will visit Anderson Ranch to accept its International Artist Award.
Results from a valley-wide survey are in, and they show strong support for allowing some e-bikes on paved trails. Elizabeth Stewart Severy reports.
Colorado law allows some electric bicycles to be used on pedestrian and multi-use paths, unless local governments decide otherwise. In the Roaring Fork Valley, this has meant inconsistent rules. Pitkin County is leading the charge to implement one policy that spans multiple jurisdictions. The county and RAFTA hired a communications firm to survey the public about e-bike use. Nearly 70% of respondents said they support the use of Class 1 pedal-assisted bikes, that is, e-bikes that only provide assistance when the rider is pedaling. Comments cited the benefits for commuting and for older people who want to stay active. More than half of those who took the survey are 50 or older. More than three quarters do not own an e-bike. Pickens County staff will recommend that the county allow the Class 1 bikes on paved trails and work with other local governments to do the same. There are still safety concerns about crowding on the Upper Rio Grande Trail during busy summer months. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
About a year ago, a home in Firestone, Colorado blew up, killing two people and seriously injuring another. The cause was a severed flow line from a nearby gas well. To prevent this from happening again, the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, or COGCC, has new requirements. They went into effect on Tuesday. Here's Wyatt.
A flow line is a pipe that carries oil and gas from the wellhead to other pipelines or storage facilities. And before the Firestone explosion, oil and gas companies didn't have to tell regulators where their flow lines were. Those days are over, according to Todd Hartman of the Colorado Department of Natural Resources. Oil and gas companies, he says,
will have to provide more detailed information about flow lines to the COGCC than they've ever had to in the past.
Oil and gas operators now have to register their flow lines and provide specific GIS data about where they start, stop, and the path they take in between. Not all this information will be made public, Hartman says, but it will be shared with local governments for emergency and planning purposes.
If you were locating a homes or a neighborhood or a big box store or something, it's certainly important to know, you know, precisely where any lines are going.
New flow lines will need to provide GIS data. Those already in existence need to be registered with the COGCC by October 31st of 2019.
A Republican House leader is facing swift backlash from his own caucus for co-sponsoring a red flag bill. It cleared the House Judiciary Committee on Tuesday along party lines. The measure would allow law enforcement and family members to get a court order to temporarily remove a person's guns if they prove to be dangerous. Benta Berkland has more.
A motion to remove Assistant Minority Leader Cole West from his leadership spot came Monday night, which was the same day the bill was introduced. It's a very unusual move. And during the hearing, West defended his support for the bill, saying if they pose a danger, mentally ill people shouldn't have guns.
It's not about gun ownership. It's not about gun confiscation. It's not about banning guns. It's about giving law enforcement, and more importantly, family, the ability to do something to save a person in crisis.
Other Republicans who backed the bill include some sheriffs and George Brockler, the GOP candidate for attorney general. Opponents say it could infringe on Second Amendment rights, doesn't have enough due process, and wouldn't help people with mental health problems. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Kristen Kay. Wyatt, we reporters all have our own individual social media accounts. I'm at KristenK29.
I'm at Wyatt_Orm.
So there are lots of ways to hear stories again, but let's talk about one.
That's right. Go to our Facebook page, and once you're there, feel free to like it.
There you can interact with our station through comments on our posts and by messaging us directly.
Tell us what you thought of a story. Send us anything you think we should be covering, all right there.
Check it out by searching Aspen Public Radio on Facebook.
Journeys into the backcountry allow adventurers to find inspiration and pursue challenge. But what happens when those adventures turn to tragedy? The nonprofit Big Heart, Big Hands supports those impacted by backcountry trauma. Last month, they co-hosted a panel discussion with Five Point Film. It focused on the ripple effect of trauma and loss that hits communities. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has more.
The panel gathered at the Kiva at True Nature in Carbondale is intimately connected to backcountry tragedy. There's Chrissy Timlin.
I lost my husband, Joe, in an avalanche on Loveland Pass.
Dave Richardson, who climbed North Maroon with his friend Jared Wetherell in 2014.
We're lost for a few days. Jared did not survive, and I was blessed because I was rescued by Mountain Rescue Aspen.
Michael Ferrara.
I'm a ski patroller. I'm a deputy sheriff. I'm a paramedic. I'm a coroner. I'm a mountain rescue member. So if you open your eyes and I'm standing above you, something has gone terribly wrong in your day.
And Jessica Haney.
I'm a local therapist partnering with Big Heart, Big Hands to offer that free kind of trauma therapeutic help.
This group was assembled to provide insights into the trauma that follows backcountry accidents. And as Richardson says, to acknowledge that survivors face a complicated path forward.
Well, I just hope that you guys get to understand what it's like to be the person that comes back from that incident that still has to look your friends' family in the eyes and say, hey, so thankful to be alive, but I also empathize and, you know, I'm going through an experience as well for as the people that lost someone.
Bobby LaRue founded Big Heart, Big Hands after Weatherall's death and moderated the discussion. It came just weeks after John Galvin, a member of Mountain Rescue Aspen, was killed in an avalanche while backcountry skiing. LaRue says the immediate community reaction in this accident, as well as many others, is to question the decision.
Why were they out there? They knew the risk. And that is the reality, but the conversation that I wanted to create was how to kind of shift out of that, like how to necessarily change your judgment or your response into being a little bit more compassionate.
And he says that starts with understanding the experiences of those most directly impacted, like Timlin. She told the audience that blame and judgment are most damaging to those left behind.
That person that you're blaming, even if there was a way for them to take responsibility for an action, if there was a way to prevent it, they're gone. So when you blame, it's the widow or the closest person that's taking that on.
That's a lot to carry, says Haney, the counselor. She explains that frequently, people impacted by traumatic incidents tend to withdraw.
The fear of not being able to move on or make sense of what's happened to you, that causes avoidance and then a pattern of isolation and withdrawal into just kind of a perpetual lonely state.
When Richardson returned after being rescued, he says he was able to talk about the incident itself and what happened.
And I could share the timeline. I could share what my thoughts were, what I thought were the right decisions we made, the wrong decisions we made. But it took a long time before I started talking about the feelings that happened afterwards.
But talking about feelings helps to chip away at some of that isolation. And this social connection, the panelists agree, is key. Friends and acquaintances can make a big difference by doing small things, Timlin says.
It's just being there and being present.
When Ferrara first started at Mountain Rescue, he would go home right after rescue missions, skipping the social time with other first responders. But he says that wasn't the best decision.
Now I understand that portion, that going out to dinner after a mission, was as important as training at the gym, of hiking smuggler with my heavy pack, is in protecting me.
It's about community, the panelists agree. And part of that means continued support for those who adventure in the backcountry. Timlin says while she misses her husband every day, she never feels anger at his choices or at others who make the decision to ski in the backcountry.
That's the last thing I wanted, is for this to have an impact that scared people out of the backcountry, that didn't want them to continue to experience the mountains and that life, because I know that that's the last thing he would have wanted.
Each panelist acknowledges that the appeal of backcountry adventures comes with risk. But when something goes wrong, they hope that survivors of all kinds find communities that will respond with compassion. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio News.
You can find a special broadcast of the panel discussion on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Thousands of teachers recently held rallies at the Colorado State Capitol to ask for more money for schools. They say there are fundamental problems with school funding, and they worry about potential changes to public pensions. Benta Berkland talks to State House reporters about why these concerns are prompting rallies during a good budget year for schools and what it means for other priorities like transportation.
Joining us today, we have Ed Sealover with the Denver Business Journal and Brian Eason with the Associated Press. The Democratic chair of the Joint Budget Committee recently told me this session she's seen the state invest more money in education since she's been down here. I've been here a while, and I've never seen teacher protests on this scale either. Brian, explain what's happening here behind the scenes.
Part of it is just a national movement right now. This all started in West Virginia, then it moved to Oklahoma. Now it's here as well as in Arizona. So I think you can't ignore the national climate, but you also can't ignore what's happening here in Colorado. This year we had more money in the budget than we've had in a long time. That has allowed lawmakers to boost education funding. There's still a lot of outstanding issues that teachers want to be addressed. We're debating massive changes to the state pension right now that ultimately, no matter what you do about it, it's going to come out of the teachers' pockets. You can raise teacher contributions. That reduces their take-home pay. Or you can reduce retirement benefits. The third kind of pillar of pension reform is raising taxpayer contributions. Well, you know, these school districts will tell you that during the last round of pension reform, when they had to increase contributions then, they responded by freezing pay of teachers in a lot of cases. And that's part of why we're in the situation we're in today.
I talked to a lot of teachers who said, look, there's been longstanding problems we've been dealing with for years, and we're just kind of fed up.
Absolutely. I mean, we're 8 years removed from the recession at this point, right? Cost of living has kept going up. The private sector economy is doing as good as it's done in decades, right? Teacher pay is still lagging.
Here's the tough part is that in Oklahoma, when teacher pay was lagging, they were able to just raise a few taxes and they could boost the funding for the schools. You can't do that in Colorado. If teachers were to say, okay, we want money coming to schools instead of transportation, then you gear up with a fight with others in the state, particularly the business community, who's saying our roads at this point are so poor that they are becoming a detriment to attracting jobs. And don't forget, those jobs are needed since the state's funding formula requires businesses to pay about 4.5 times what homes pay in the property taxes that fund schools.
Especially Republican leadership in the building has said you don't have to pit education against transportation. Is there a way to avoid that when these are two sizable things in the budget? They are competing for a limited pot of money.
I don't see a way to avoid that fight, right? The transportation bonds that Republicans want to see would earmark hundreds of millions of dollars a year for 20 years to pay off some transportation bonds. Well, you know, if I'm a teacher and I'm looking at that and I'm looking at, well, what happens in the next recession? Well, what happened in the last recession? Last recession, we cut a bunch of education funding. So what happens in the next one? Well, you can't cut the transportation funding because that's, you know, the full faith and credit of the states behind it. We have to pay off those bonds. So when lawmakers have to go back and look at where do we take this money from, teachers are concerned that it's going to come right back out of the pockets of schools.
And that's not just at the legislature either. Let's not forget there is a ballot initiative that is going through the process that could raise some taxes for education. There is also a number of ballot initiatives going through the process set to raise sales taxes for transportation. If both of those end up on the 2018 ballot, it almost assures both of them will lose. And then we are back at the table asking how we can fund both of these important areas in 2019. I almost feel like we have to get the education and transportation forces talking together about how they can mutually benefit from whatever is to come.
Ed Seelover with the Denver Business Journal, Brian Eason with the Associated Press. I'm Benta Berkland, and you've been listening to Capital Conversation.
When those thousands of teachers rallied last week, several districts ended up canceling class for the day. They couldn't find enough substitutes. The Roaring Fork School District remained open, but some of its teachers went to Denver. And last Thursday, a group who stayed behind took to the streets, or the sidewalks at least, to drum up public support. Wyatt was there and brings us this report.
It's a sunny afternoon. School is out. And 100 teachers or so from the Roaring Fork School District wave signs before the traffic crawling through Glenwood Springs.
Want to whip out a honk for education sign?
Shayna Matham teaches English at Glenwood Springs High School. Her sign reads,
if the Broncos were in 45th place, people would care.
Colorado is actually 32nd in the country for average teacher salaries. The state spends roughly $2,700 less per student than the national average. And 95% of rural educators are paid below the cost of living. Lots of teachers feel they need extra jobs.
I probably have over 5 or 6 jobs just so I can afford to live here.
Autumn Rivera says this kind of hustle can wear people down. It's not sustainable. She teaches science at Glenwood Springs Middle School. The year she started, she was among 13 new teachers on staff.
Since then, in 6 years, there's 3 of us left, 4 of us left that have been there since those 13 started.
I've heard recently from staff members who are selling their car so they can stay
and work for us.
Rob Stein is the superintendent of the Roaring Fork School District. The staffing shortages, the turnover, it's starting to reach a crisis level, he says.
We're reaching the point where we have positions that we don't know if we can fill.
Of course, the district does have the option of asking its voters for more money. They have in the past. But Stein says even if the voters say yes, it still won't be enough. So each school from the district sent 4 representatives to Denver. They want better retirement benefits, they want higher salaries, and they want more money spent on students. And they want all these things passed before the legislative session ends on May 9th. Colorado is one of many states where teachers are making these kinds of demands. In places like West Virginia, teachers have gone on strike for days at a time to pressure lawmakers. Some teachers with the Roaring Fork School District would consider striking.
If a big enough group to make an impact would strike, then absolutely.
But a big enough group probably won't strike in Colorado. That's according to Carrie Dahlman, who's the president of the Colorado Education Association, or the CEA, which is the teachers' union organizing the rallies in Denver.
We will not have a strike.
Dahlman says teachers in many of the state's districts sign contracts that explicitly say they're not allowed to strike. The union's leverage, then, comes from engaging its members and the communities around them, getting lots of pressure on their elected officials. And Dahlman says it's working.
It is clear that our advocacy efforts are making a difference.
Legislation is still shaking out in the halls of the Capitol, but the House did approve a bill regarding the public pension program, which had the support of the CEA. The night before the rally in Glenwood Springs, the board of the Roaring Fork School District met. Dozens of teachers attended as well, and they watched as the board signed a resolution supporting the activism in Denver. At one point, the board broke up into small groups with the teachers and brainstormed ways the district and teachers could work together to support the teachers' cause.
I'm big on phoning people. Phoning and phoning and phoning. By people, I mean legislators.
Energizing the community, calling their legislators, it might be the most impactful thing these teachers can do, they say. Whether or not it changes anything permanently, it's too early to say.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Wyatt Orme. In other news, students in Carbondale rallied for school safety last week.
The House and Senate are getting closer to finalizing a bill to fund the Colorado Civil Rights Commission.
State funding to protect lakes and reservoirs from invasive mussels might not make a dent in local costs.
Those stories and more news are on our website now. Take a listen at aspenpublicradio.org.
Officials hope to improve water quality, fish habitat, and a diversion structure along the Crystal River in Carbondale. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy has more.
The Crystal River Management Plan identified the mile-and-a-half reach that flows through River Valley Ranch in Carbondale as needing restoration to improve habitat. 7 organizations, including the Town of Carbondale, Roaring Fork Conservancy, and Aspen Valley Land Trust, as well as state and national groups, have teamed up. The goal is to restore both the in-stream habitat for fish and riparian areas near Riverfront Park. The project will also replace the aging headgate of the Weaver Ditch, which runs through the town of Carbondale. This will mean less maintenance, says Heather Lewin with the Roaring Fork Conservancy.
So you're seeing in-stream benefits, but you're also seeing potential benefit to town of Carbondale and being able to deliver their water more efficiently.
The project team began analysis of the site last week. Design work could start this summer, with construction slated for 2019. Elizabeth Stewart-Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Architecture might be the art form that's the most accessible. Not everyone goes to a concert or even sees a painting every day, but almost everyone experiences building design. Kristen looked into the unique traits and challenges of design in the Roaring Fork Valley. She sat down with our host, Carolyn Heldman, to discuss.
Is there an Aspen style? What's distinctive?
So here in the Roaring Fork Valley, we kind of have the best of worlds and the worst of worlds when it comes to architecture. One thing that does set us apart, it takes a long time to get something built here, like 6 to 8 months just for permitting, as opposed to the standard 1 month. The Aspen Art Museum recently hosted a panel discussion about local architecture, and John Cottle, partner and principal of CCY Architects, noted that the stringent building requirements and the long permitting process does serve a purpose.
Every year, Aspen is more of a pain in the neck, and every year, I am more aware of how remarkable this community is.
Aha. So what makes this community remarkable as far as architecture?
Well, there's a huge pool here of talented architects, and there's, of course, a lot of inspiration to be found in our surroundings. Also, we have a rich history, literally. Aspen was a mining town with a lot of money, and during those days, some of our most iconic historic buildings were constructed, like the Wheeler Opera House, and they were built to last, and they're still around today. And wealth and a taste for the finer things is still pretty inextricable from today's architecture in Aspen. Architects here consistently cite their clients' sophistication as something that sets us apart.
Well, okay, that's nice. But did you hear about particular challenges facing the designers here?
Yeah, for one, our conflicting cultural values. Lots of people here don't want sprawl, but they don't want density either. There just hasn't been the political appetite for density in the core of Aspen up to this point. At that same discussion about local architecture, Charles Cuniff, the principal at his firm, noted that what we say we don't want here is something people seek out elsewhere.
If you look at any great European town, the density is in the city. It's in the core. That means you have to allow some height. You have to allow some closeness. But those communities that we want to vacation at are what we're not letting this community be.
And it's unfortunate today, not as much as being built with that legacy mindset of those Valley classics like the Wheeler or the Durand Opera House. Sarah Broughton, principal at Rowland and Broughton, says she's seeing a trend toward what's called speculative building. People hoping values go up quickly. They use cheaper materials, so buildings aren't really made to last. Obviously, that adds a lot of waste to the landfill, and it isn't a great choice for the environment. Broughton cited that Aspen buildings have an average life of about 20 years, which is nothing.
Well, can architects control that at all? Can they talk their clients into more green choices?
The panelists said they do try to educate clients about what materials and design choices are the most environmentally friendly, but ultimately clients get what they want and architects have to make a living too.
It's really expensive to build here, obviously. Does that mean only the uber rich can afford well-designed, environmentally friendly buildings?
Building costs in Aspen start at $700 a square foot. Often, it's the case that more money does get you a better built environment. There are some local architects who are challenging that, though. I talked to Ashley Clark at Studio B. She's a relatively new designer, and she says that she sees a trend with her millennial colleagues of volunteering their services for nonprofits and an attitude of giving back so that more people have access to good design. Steve Novi is the principal of Greenline Architects. They designed and built the new Restore building with sustainability and energy efficiency in mind. And that project was certainly one with a budget.
So looking into the future, what's on the horizon?
Well, Scott Lindenau brought up something that stopped me in my tracks and made me really see how intertwined design is with so many of our other conversations here about housing and resources and space.
The population of Colorado will double in the next 20 years, with 10% of that coming into the Western Slope. So we have to, you know, address change, embrace change, and how we deal with change is something we're going to have to contend with.
So where will those potentially thousands of more people in the Valley go? Architects say they're problem solvers. That's a challenge they're going to have to take on.
Yeah, right. Well, thanks, Kristen.
Thanks, Carolyn. That's all for Mountain Edition this week. I'm Kristen Kay.
And I'm Wyatt Orm. You can find more news from the Roaring Fork Valley and from all around the world on our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Join Allison Bechtesh tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. She'll be joined by columnists Lorenzo Semple and Roger Marolt, along with State House reporter Benta Berkland.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.